This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Forget the frustration of picking commerce platforms when you switch your business to Shopify, the global commerce platform that supercharges your selling wherever you sell. With Shopify, you'll harness the same intuitive features, trusted apps, and powerful analytics used by the world's leading brands. Sign up today for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/tech, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/tech.
Sign up to The Economist for in-depth curated expert analysis of world events and topics ranging from business and culture to science and technology. You'll get the weekly digital edition, online-only articles, curated newsletters on politics, the markets, science, culture and China, and full access to The Economist Podcast Plus. The Economist is independent journalism for independent thinking. Go to economist.com and get your first month free.
Hello and welcome back to The Bunker with me, Andrew Harrison. On this week's edition, Instant Starmer's gonna get you. What will Keir Starmer's sacking of Chief Corps Minister Rebecca Long-Bailey after she shared a newspaper story containing an anti-Semitic conspiracy theory mean for Labour's new era of peace and tranquility? What's the story for McGlory? Philip Sargent, author of The Art of Political Storytelling, joins us to talk about the insidious power of narrative in politics, how populists always promise to restore past greatness, and what sort of stories we'll need to fix the world in years to come. And, speaking of once and future glories, what can we learn about leadership, inspiration, honesty, and the power of a good set of teeth from Jurgen Klopp, manager of Liverpool FC, champions of Europe, the world, and now England too? I'm not biased at all. All this and more in today's Bunker. Hello, welcome back to the weekly edition of The Bunker. Remember, we've got a gala Zoom live stream with Romaniacs next week on Thursday, 9th of July at 8 p.m, and it's exclusive to Patreon backers of either show. If you're not registered already, then search Patreon Bunker Podcast to find out how. It should be a good fun night. Now, let's meet today's panel. Helen Lewis is a staff writer on The Atlantic, where she's just written a big piece about the Conservative case for divorce reform, and nobody's talking about it because it's just a culture war issue. Helen, do you feel swizzed? This should be front and centre.
I kind of do, actually. I wrote in my book about divorce reform and about no-fault divorce and how important that was, right? At the moment, you have to use a blame grounds, or you have to wait for a separation of 2 years or 5 years if the other half of the party contests it, which is sort of a mad idea anyway, that you kind of say, I don't want to be married to you anymore, and someone goes, wait, if you just think about it for another 5 years, maybe I can continue on. Yeah. It's just gone royal assent last week. And so 100,000 couples a year get divorced. I suspect that will be slightly higher after lockdown. It's a massive, massive change. And everyone in the kind of family court system is behind it. Much better for children if you don't have to basically, if you want to get divorced quickly, turn up on day one of a court hearing and go, here's how you're a bastard. And then go, like, let's have an amicable division of our assets and access to our children. So it's this huge, wonderful, you know, very feminist, very progressive reform put through by a Conservative government. But presumably because of that, the Conservatives haven't briefed the lobby on it, and therefore none of them are able to write things up on their own. Sorry, that's a bit overly harsh. But you know, it's not been pushed by them as a kind of victory over anyone, because it's not really. It's a victory over, you know, the concept of arguments rather than over the Labour Party. So there's no real prism for writing about it.
Well, let it be said, we don't say nice things about the Conservative government once in a while. But let's stop that right now.
That's the quota hit, Andrew. It's okay.
Yeah, you can absolutely. Relax. Quota hit. Let's go back to being horrible. I mean, the defenestration of Sir Mark Sedwill this week, the UK's top civil servant, forced out with Brexit negotiator David Frost, a famously amicable man, in line to replace him. You know, what happened here did Dominic Cummings just need to go and punch the hardest guy in the kind of exercise yard now that he's out of solitary? Is it just a statement of restatement of power?
I mean, if you've seen any photos of Mark Sedwill, it's not the description that would have sprung instantly to mind of him, nor of Dominic Cummings, really, particularly. But so David Frost is going to be National Security Advisor, which was previously given to sort of a non-party political appointment. It was a civil service trustee, but he's going in as a political appointment, like equivalent to a special advisor, really. So it's politicising that role and kind of making it one that's much more in the gift of the Prime Minister. The other half of it, which is the heading up the civil service, will go to someone else. And there's now a fierce and feisty battle among all the various heads of department. They said it's got to be someone who's a permanent secretary already who's going to get that. And that's a really key role. That's essentially, you know, running the government in a kind of non-party political way. But, you know, the interesting thing about it is that one of the heads, that's the head of the DWP, I think, has sort of let it be known he was the only permanent secretary who actually voted for Brexit. And so it is a culture war to that extent, in that they don't just necessarily want the best administrator for the job. They want somebody who agrees with them on, you know, whether it's Brexit or Brexit as a proxy for a whole range of other things. But yeah, this has been Dominic Cummings' obsession for an incredibly long time about decentralising and smashing stuff up. But what it seems to actually really mean in practice is that Michael Gove gets to do all the things that Boris Johnson can't be bothered to do, and then everyone else does what they tell them to.
Sounds great. Also with us is Ahir Shah, a comedian, writer for The Mash Report, currently writing for his mate Nish Kumar and doing The Bunker on secret toilet breaks. Hello, Ahir. How are you doing?
If anything, I'm not able to do The Bunker on toilet break. This would be my toilet break. So, you know, I'm doing this podcast. I'm holding it in. I'm feeling very powerful.
So we saw Boris Johnson doing press-ups for the Mail on Sunday at the weekend. But what is going to be next? Is he going to drink a glass of water and then, like, throw the glass away? Is he going to be seen riding a bear like Putin?
I think that he's going to walk down a ramp in a very measured and assured manner and then spend a lot of time telling us how measured and assured it was, perhaps in front of his new favourite lectern that says build, 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 which is very exciting.
What is it with these guys on the kind of authoritarian right-wing side that they need to be seen to be doing stuff that could go on a calendar? You know, they need to be seen to be doing this more performative. Look at me. I tore a phone book in half. Somebody said, this is government like Finchy from The Office, you know, throwing a kettle over a pub is a kind of an example of your political virility.
Well, I mean, as someone who was a stand-up comedian when that was still allowed, I am in absolutely no position to judge anyone on ridiculously futile acts of performance.
As I mentioned earlier, we're joined by Philip Sargent, author of the book The Art of Political Storytelling, Why Stories Win Votes in Post-Truth Politics, and he's also an Open University professor. Hello, Philip. How are you doing? Thanks for joining us.
Thanks very much for inviting me along. I'm fine at the moment.
Jolly good. You can't write about politics without writing about social media, where the kind of narratives of post-truth politics all take place. This week, Mark Zuckerberg's lost about $7 billion after Unilever said that they're going to boycott Facebook advertising. Starbucks are also pulling out. Do you think that, you know, in that particular arena, the worm may be turning?
Yes, I guess. I mean, but only after it's turned very far in the other direction over the last few years. It's interesting to look at the way that that social media has been seen in relation to politics, where sort of 10 years ago it was valorized as a huge democratic force for good, and then I suppose mid last decade it all started going wrong, and it's just gone worse and worse for them. I mean, a lot to do with the way that they've actually managed things themselves. So I suppose this is an attempt to claw things back a little bit, both on a sort of PR front, but also, more importantly, on actually the impact it's having on people's lives and indeed democracy in general.
Let's start by focusing on everyone's favourite dysfunctional family, the Labour Party. In a clear act of socialist distancing, Keir Starmer sacked Rebecca Long-Bailey from the Shadow Cabinet. She'd shared an interview with Maxine Peake, which contained anti-Semitic conspiracy theory. Starmer had promised to get tough on anti-Semitism, but many on the party's left are claiming vindictiveness on his part. Helen, the left were very quick to say criticising Israel isn't anti-Semitic. What was actually in the Peake interview that triggered this?
So she said that systemic racism was global, and that the police who had kneeled on George Floyd's neck in the US had learned this from, quote, the Israeli secret services. And now this is, you know, there is, it's one of those things about conspiracy theories, is there's a fundamental grain of truth in it, which is that police departments across the world share tactics that they use. But it's not like, I think as Stephen Bush wrote, it's not like, you know, Israel didn't invent the concept of the knee restraints, right? And actually what it does is it is that classic left-wing anti-Semitic conspiracy theory where everything kind of goes back to Israel, particularly the invocation of presumably Mossad in this, right? Which is one of those things that kind of crops up, that people seem to think that Mossad did everything right up to and including 9/11. But the weird thing about it was that Maxine Peake disavowed it. So it was a sort of strange hill for the Labour left to die on, that there was nothing wrong with her retweeting it or endorsing it. But it is true that, you know, the very first thing that Keir Starmer said in his acceptance speech when he won the Labour leadership was, you know, this is a zero tolerance environment. You know, I'm absolutely concerned with rebuilding my relationship with the Jewish community. And you know what? That's been really important, because he's done something else this week that's been, you know, Lisa Nandy's come out and said, you know, we should have a boycott of anything produced outside Israel's 1967 borders if Netanyahu's government annexes further parts of the West Bank. So what that's allowed him to do is to separate out conspiracy theories about Israel with criticisms of current Israeli policies in its surrounding environment. And that was always the really important thing. And I never really bought the you can't criticize Israel thing, because Ed Miliband, you know, used to criticize Israel, was quite sympathetic to Palestinian statehood and all of that kind of stuff that is actually about Israel as a country rather than as a kind of bogeyman.
Corbynist to Twitter was awash with people claiming that Starmer was just looking for a reason to sack it, and this was a kind of a statement. I mean, do you think that was the case? I mean, 44% of Labour voters thought he was right to sack her.
I think what was surprised was that she wasn't allowed to apologise and delete it. And now there's some contradiction between the accounts from the Starmer camp and the Long Bailey camp about what exactly happened. Something definitely happened, and and her initial response was either kind of deemed truculent or not enough. As the trouble is, I don't think as a party leader, it's very hard to find situations in which sacking someone is deemed to be wrong, because most people don't know who they don't know who the opposition leader is for a start, right? And they certainly don't know into the granular detail of who shadow ministers are. So I think the presumption tends to be that if someone got sacked, they must have done something wrong. And people like their leaders to be strong and decisive. That's the other thing. And the weirdest thing that came out saying, well, he won't call for the sacking of Robert Jenrick, but he'll sack his own minister. And you're like, well, he's in charge of his own cabinet. And actually what that very firm line on Rebecca Long Bailey does is gives him the moral authority to say, this is a party that cleans its house up, you know.
And at some degree of cost to the party, because there was an awful lot of sort of pearl clutching about party unity from certain quarters. Starmer has thrown this under the bus. He's clearly not interested in, bringing anything of the Labour Party's previous positioning into the current party. Do you think that's true, or do you think it's kind of special pleading a little bit from certain of the former big figures of the old Labour left?
No, I think it's true. I think it's right to say that he prioritised sending a strong signal to Jewish communities over keeping someone in his cabinet, which would have been better for not rocking the boat. As we're talking, there's a National Executive Committee meeting on in which they're discussing the changes to the election systems, whether or not it should be a simple majority or a single transferable vote. There we go. And there was a hilarious article this week in Tribune magazine, which is the left-wing magazine of choice. It's sort of Novara for people with a slow internet connection.
About Slovara.
Slovara, there we go. About the fact that it was vitally important that the system didn't change to a single transferable vote because this would be bad for democracy. Never, ever, ever explaining why. And you kind of have to assume, reading through the lines, is that would be bad for Unite's representation. And actually the big contest of the Corbyn era for the power in the party was between the Unite Union, which provided all the cash, and Momentum, which provided all the kind of campaigning heft, really. Starmer has to play those factions off against each other. He can't afford to alienate absolutely everybody and just rely on the soft left and the old right of the party, because he needs, you know, there's still a huge Momentum slate representation on the National Executive Committee, which is where all the rules get made. So he's got to walk a pretty fine line, and this may come back to haunt him in some respects.
I hear. What do you take away from this? I mean, it did look like Rebecca Long Bailey was kind of bang to rights here.
I mean, everything that I am going to say about the Labour Party and the left needs to be taken with the understanding that you may occasionally hear a click-clack in the background because my girlfriend is literally preparing avocado toast for lunch.
Tell us more about millennials, I hear.
Yeah.
You'll never be able to afford a house if you eat avocado on toast.
Louisa, we could have bought a house if you weren't doing this. So, I mean, look, it's always going to be the case that sort of a side calls for unity when they're in charge and seeks to be annoyed at things when they're not in charge. And what feels increasingly abnormal to me is quite I know Twitter isn't the world. Obviously, Twitter isn't the world. But that has become increasingly stark, I think, over the last while of lockdown when I sort of open this app and open my window, and things just feel instinctively very, very different. So I think maybe it just is the case that, you know, these are people who you shouldn't doubt people's sort of sincere commitment to what they feel is the right way to create a better world. But yeah, so maybe people just feel the need to be sort of annoyed about this and feel themselves being marginalized, and talking about it on Twitter is a way to get around that and feel a bit less alone.
I did think about that, actually, about the fact that obviously one thing there haven't been is constituency Labour Party meetings because of lockdown for several months. And that has removed a big, I mean, you can either say intimidation mechanism or kind of enthusiasm mechanism, right? Is that people aren't having to sit with beside people through endless motions. I mean, I think of some of the stuff that happened in Luciana Berger's local party, right? About the motions against her and the kind of really big ill feeling about her. All of that's been kind of put on pause. So I think that has been a real issue for Momentum and for some of the Labour left organising, is that actually Twitter's kind of what they've got left, if you see what I mean. Mm.
Philip, this is all happening against a backdrop of Starmer getting increasingly good poll ratings, performing increasingly well in the Commons, getting the strong impression that the Conservatives are genuinely concerned about this. You know, Starmer is often criticised for not taking a sufficiently confrontational approach, not sort of doing enough condemnation. Are you impressed with it so far?
Yeah, I mean, I think the other interesting thing about this, the substantive issue aside, is presumably it sort of links to his attitude of what's going to happen with social media, because he's stamped it out immediately. He's sort of cut it off. And these days there seem to be sort of two ways to treat social media. One, there is to be very cautious about it, realise things can flare up for no reason, or not for no reason, but flare up in ways that you can get completely out of control. And although, yeah, the general population, most of them don't care about what's going on Twitter. The trouble is a lot of the people who write for the papers and who appear on television do. So it sort of filters out. So there's one way to sort of control it. The other way is to embrace it and double down and do the sort of, you know, the Donald Trump provoking conflict, provoking outrage, provoking, and then just follow through with it. And obviously, Starmer's very keen not to do that, which fits with his personality. So I think that, you know, just immediately cutting it off, as you say, there are very complex, very important discussions to be had about the relationship between the Israeli state, the Israeli government, notions of Jewishness and stuff. But Twitter, or indeed any sort of social media, is so clearly not the place to have these, because it simplifies, because it leads to conflict and so forth. So I think from that point of view, it's an interesting approach he's taking. He is using social media a lot. He puts out regular little videos and things, but he's not using it as a tool to rile up the base, which so many people have done.
The collapse of the power of Momentum has been really fast and almost total. I mean, they've gone from kingmakers to kind of hecklers from the sidelines in a matter of months. Helen, what do you think this portends for the future of the left, as it were? I mean, is this now their role?
I wouldn't rule them out. I mean, I still think the organising base is quite strong, and it's a big member-led organisation particularly. But I think the scale of the defeat was just simply so large in December that the average Labour member is kind of reconciled to the idea that something had to change. And I think that's part of the reason that Rebecca Long-Bailey didn't win the leadership, is she was basically saying, you know, oh, Brexit was the reason we lost the election and everything else was basically fine. And I don't think that was the majority. Well, clearly wasn't the majority opinion, because Keir Starmer won by a pretty significant majority. But the interesting thing is about where that energy goes. And I think it speaks a bit to Philip's book, actually, about the power of storytelling and kind of tribal signalling. You know, Labour has now got a tougher position on Israel than it had under either Ed Miliband or Jeremy Corbyn in policy terms. And it's whether or not do activists value the policy position, or do they value the tribal signals more highly? So, you know, you always have to look behind what people are saying that they want to what they actually want. And this has been a very, I think I'd say the same about Lloyd Russell Moyle, you know, and his accusation that J.K. Rowling was weaponizing her sexual assault. And again, he got put back in his box pretty quickly. And there is a feeling now that bit of the left, which I would associate him with too, is very much, you know, on the wane and has to kind of, you know, hasn't got a big enough power base still in the party that it can kind of throw its weight around and expect to get away with it.
Also, Helen, your point about sort of the substantive policy position versus like a more abstract feeling very much reminded me of your very, very good piece about work capitalism, which you will not plug yourself, but I will plug
for. That's very nice of you. I mean, that's a bit, you're taking a big risk by saying I wouldn't plug that myself, but yes, I
think... you haven't done so yet.
No, it's something I've been thinking about a lot. So I have a newsletter, which is helenlewis.substack.com, and I wrote a piece about what I call woke capitalism. And that's not a dismissive, right-wing use of the word woke. The idea of actually becoming alert to social injustice is not an absurd one. What is absurd is the fact that you get in this situation where, you have diversity trainings and companies that have no real evidence base behind them, when they could be like paying their cleaners a living wage or making sure that you hire junior staff at a rate that means someone who comes from a normal background, maybe they've got immigrant parents, maybe went to a state school, they're just a normal regular person, can afford to live in a city where your company is based. And that kind of stuff, I think, is really social media. It's the thing that social media has done to the left, that is, it has made it value those tokenistic symbols really highly over the kind of grinding stuff about structural change. But I put jokes in as well. I'd like to say that I always and that's what's important.
Stay off my turf.
Now, who remembers truth? It was great, wasn't it? For the past 5 years, we've been living in a post-truth world where tapping into emotion has proved far more effective than rational argument. We've seen it firsthand here in the UK with Brexit, in the United States with the election of Donald Trump, and across the world. And what gets all this stuff over the line is stories, as today's guest Philip Sargent writes in The Art of Political Storytelling, Why Stories Win Votes in Post-Truth Politics. Philip, the past few years have felt like agony for reality-based politics, with horrible concepts like alternative facts and fake news being weaponized. But is that stuff actually that new? Politicians have always been storytellers, and they've always been fast and loose with the truth. Are we just giving new names to old things?
Yes and no, I guess, is the answer to that. To an extent, yes, it's always been the case. You go back, to the ancient Greeks and so forth, and there's the idea that truth is the first casualty of a war and so forth, and it's always been the case that to an extent people will spin or lie or what have you, but I think it's become very much more significant in the last few years in a way which is, as you say, slightly worrying. Talking briefly about conspiracy theories and so forth, there's this sort of very mainstream sense in the world that there's a superficial level of what's happening, and then underneath that there's the real truth. And our whole politics is sort of based on this at the moment, in a very bizarre and worrying way.
Yeah, I mean, there's a kind of a need for things to be more complex than they really are. And people like Francis Wheen and David Aronovich have written about this, the idea that, conspiracy theory and the idea that the truth is being held from you is fundamentally a narcissistic thing, because it puts you, the person who spotted it, at the centre of the story, when in fact, in reality, possibly you're not, possibly you're just another member of the crowd. I mean, do you think that the validity and the importance of political storytelling has become more important in recent years, because it's always been a narrative thing, hasn't it?
Yeah, I mean, I suppose the point I make is narrative storytelling in and of itself is not a problem. Storytelling can be an excellent way of explaining something to someone, so it doesn't. It's not necessarily.
I really like the idea, Philip, that you would just come out and be just anti any kind of storytelling, like the lame to Aesop. Fuck off.
But I mean, it's an educational tool. It's a good way of, as you say, with fables or something, a good way of putting forward points in a way that's relatable and so forth. So there's that. And at the same time, one of the things that storytelling does often is simplify issues. And one of the things that cuts through a lot in political rhetoric and so forth is also something which simplifies something for people. And I think that's one of the big problems we've had. I mean, something like Brexit or something, pro-Brexit this is, based on a very simple story of what national identity in the UK is. And that sort of... that's become so important for all the discussions we've had about Brexit over the last 4 years, that the facts, the actual practical things, sort of don't have no sort of traction at all. And at some stage, you would assume there will be a clash between the two.
What's interesting, one of the many interesting things in the book is that you kind of demonstrate how the story that most populists will tell about themselves is so Hollywood that it's almost corny. You know, if presented in the form of a movie, would be regarded as too corny. It's a lone outsider from a humble background against a giant machine. It's basically Star Wars. It's like trying to find the hole in the back of the Death Star. This is Joseph Campbell stuff. Was that an insight that, you know, campaigners in kind of post-war politics found that they should essentially be presenting politics as Hollywood?
I think probably that's become more and more the case over the last, 30 years or so, as politics and entertainment have grown together. I mean, Trump has based his whole political career on this idea that he's an outsider to Washington, that he has this different type of experience, that he gave up his comfortable lifestyle to come and save the country and stuff. And even when he's in power, he's still trying to press that same bloody story, you know. He's still being beset by deep state officials and so forth. He's still fighting against the establishment. So again, I think it's partly what the political establishment itself has done, but also the way that the media has changed and news reporting has changed again over the last sort of 30 years. It's personality driven. It's driven by conflict. It's driven by all these things which sort of relate directly to storytelling and which often can push out more obscure and detailed arguments about the actual policy and so forth.
You've made a pretty good case of Donald Trump as the hero of a particular kind of story, but how does that apply to, how does that leave Boris Johnson? How does that apply to him? It's hardly an heroic journey, is it? It's more just William than Arnold Schwarzenegger. Do the same rules apply here?
It sort of is, but if you look the sort of basic template, again, he's always set himself up as an outsider. Now, this is very much the difference between the persona he puts forward of, you know, a straight talker, a flamboyant character, someone who's different from the run of the mill of Westminster politicians.
Andrew, I think I would disagree that Boris Johnson's story isn't heroic, because in some sense, it's like a heroic story is one in which something has to be overcome. And when the thing that's overcome is the very idea of reality, it's probably the biggest thing that you can possibly overcome in the world. And like, what a heroic journey to overcome reality and become a man who is unencumbered by literally anything is, it's impressive in its own way.
It's very Lewis Carroll, I'll give you that.
There seems to be a fundamental difference between storytelling and governing. Are we going to keep electing storytellers who couldn't run a Welk stall?
I mean, that's a very good question. I think with Trump, we're at that point now. You know, he thrived, or he skated on this notion of his larger-than-life personality as an outsider and so forth. But obviously, to be put it rather simplistically, politics is a mixture of persuasion but also policy. And now Trump is being confronted by the inadequacies of any sort of political strategy around COVID, to the extent that the US is not getting on top of the situation in any real sense.
I mean, yeah, tens of thousands of new infections a day. I think that's the thing I find most interesting about coronavirus as a political story, is the fact that it is just so unsusceptible to spin, because it just keeps infecting people. It doesn't really care what anyone says on Twitter. Like, it just keeps on spreading through droplets. And therefore, it has really exposed a certain type of kind of populist leader as someone who can, obviously, as you say, talk a good game about how the deep state is holding them back, but can't actually, you know, distribute medical resources or, you know, run public health awareness campaigns.
Helen, I feel like I have to believe that there is something other than just people respond to a great story and don't care about the substance of who's really that, purely because that idea is literally the ending of Game of Thrones and it was so bad. So when you talked about sort of obviously the tradition of storytelling in politics, going back to the ancient world, this has been around for a very long time. I just feel as though with the advent of social media and the comparative interconnectedness of the world now, and before, at what stage does a difference in degree become a different in kind? You know,
I think you can call it a difference in kind as of sort of 2016.
Right.
That it's, well, you see a range of these particular types of personalities, usually populist personalities, suddenly without any sense of experience or any sense of realistic vision getting into power. So, I mean, Bill Clinton and Barack Obama both ran on particular stories of hope and changing America, which was embodied in their own life stories. But suddenly with Trump, it's partly because of social media, partly, I think, because of the rise of things like Fox News and so forth, which really, I mean, yeah, okay, so that was earlier in the century a little bit, but has really amplified, as I say, particularly this notion of conflict, particularly this notion of personalities in conflict, and has generated a sort of a non-stop desire for drama, for want of a better word.
So finally, I mean, we're at the beginning of a decade in a world that's been completely shaped by stories that bear decreasing relevance to reality. People feel starved of basic competence. They feel starved of the boring business of getting things done. It's the next story arc of a Mr. Starmer who goes to Westminster promising the ability to just get stuff done without flannel.
Yeah, I think that, to what extent that takes hold and is persuasive is another question. But I think that's very much one of the ideas that he's running on, the idea that he's an anti-Boris Johnson, even an anti-Jeremy Corbyn. He's doing something different, competency and so forth. And to an extent, what happens between Trump and Biden, Biden's campaign at the moment is pretty much just not being Donald Trump. Mm-hmm. Yeah, at the moment, there isn't a sort of very positive an obviously positive story that's going to replace the situation we're in. It's just if a complete fatigue and a sense of reality about the implausibility of the types of stories that have been running so far just takes over, and we'll have something else instead, simply by default. Something might yet spring up to replace that. But there's a sort of, as I say, a fatigue in this post-truth nonsense at the moment as well. As far as I can see, that's the only saving grace on the horizon.
One of my favourite things about the way that I've thought about political stories recently has been that my mum got really into watching PMQs over lockdown. and she, like many people, you know, she's retired now, but was a public sector worker in a union, sort of voted Labour, is an immigrant, sort of followed the news, but never like followed it because she had a lot of other shit on. And it was really interesting after spending a day just looking at all of this stuff on Twitter, getting a text from my mum after she'd watched the PMQs, just saying like, oh, I've been looking into this Mr. Starmer, and it seems like regular guy, worked hard, did well for himself, and he looks out for people like us. And I was just like, great. Mother, never get Twitter. Never get Twitter. You're 63 years on this earth and you are still so pure. Never get Twitter, please.
Finally, we need to talk about Jürgen. Let's end with some good news for the whole country. Liverpool FC won the Premier League last week when Chelsea beat Man City, bringing Liverpool's haul up to 19 top-flight titles, and something that I know absolutely everybody will be as delighted as me about. For many people, the standout image wasn't Liverpool fans with flares or Gary Neville fleeing to Papua New Guinea. It was the normally stoic Klopp breaking down in tears when he dedicated the victory to Kenny Dalglish, to Jamie Carragher, to former players, to the fans. It really got to me. I don't know about you. What is it about Jürgen? I love him, obviously, but so does everybody else. He's the manager that everybody wishes they had. I hear. What's so impressive about Klopp? What do you think about him?
I love what a loaded question that is, and I totally admire it.
How much do you love Jürgen? Do you love him more than me?
I love him a very great deal. Like, in a way that I wouldn't want to think too much about, because I think the root of it is just we've become so like ground down by so much of reality that it's just really refreshing to see someone who seems normal and kind. And I think that's why everyone's a fan of him. Because it's like, oh, you seem like you're not, I bet you're a good dad. that's what you really think.
Yeah, it's just a good humour and a good laugh. Yeah. Helen, are you a football follower?
I'm going to say, I'll bite, Andrew. What's football?
Right, okay. It's a spherical object. You must have come across Klopp in your...
I have, actually. I've read... In fact, my main interaction with him was reading an extremely long Twitter thread of someone's fan fiction about all the variously dad-like but filthy things they wanted to do with Jürgen Klopp.
Laura's thread. Really good.
Yeah.
And I thought that... And I think he has picked it up right, actually. It is the kind of dad energy. It's what I not to get on my feminist high horse, but I think it is really genuinely quite difficult to find models of masculinity that aren't kind of brittle and blokey in a sort of unpleasantly kind of, you know, Boris Johnson-y kind of way, right? But just someone who seems to be both authoritative and kind of caring, and that balance is quite sweet and attractive, I think.
Yeah, and I mean, his wild enthusiasm and his crazy teeth and the fact that he's kind of, he has really welded not just the team, but also all the fans into one big unit.
Also, like, he wears a cap and he pulls it off, but it's not an evil cap. That's unusual in the world.
it's kind of endearingly naff. Philip, how about you? Are you a football person?
I'm not a huge football person. To what extent I've got anything useful or sensible to say about this, I don't know. But I suppose the thing that comes across with him is that, he's a very measured sense of himself and indeed sense of the team, while at the same being obviously passionate and very successful about it. And that sense that he knows what he knows and he's happy to not talk about what he doesn't know, if you see what I mean.
Yeah, I mean, well, from a story point of view, Jürgen is absolutely the best thing that could happen to Liverpool, you know, because we've had, you know, numerous restarts and people who weren't quite there. And then a guy comes in and you just know it's going to be all right. You know, he manages through feel good. He's brought everybody into the group and made them one thing, not just the players, but the backroom staff, the fans, everybody. I've been listening to management podcasts about Jürgen Klopp's way of running things, and I've kind of come to the conclusion that he's actually the boss everybody wishes they could have in all of their jobs. You know, all the crap bosses we've all had.
I'm self-employed and I wish he was my boss.
There you go.
I want to be him.
Yeah, it's like the, you know, the bad bosses you've had who sort of say one thing and then do another, or who throw, you know, underlings under the bus, who kind of punch down and kind of grovel upwards. He doesn't do any of those things. And apparently when he gets rid of a player, he'll like take half a day to spend time with him explaining why it's happening. People have described walking past Jürgen's office to see Jürgen hugging a player who's crying as he lets him go. There was a case with the goalkeeper Karius who really blew it in a European Cup final. And what most managers would do would like basically make him the scapegoat, fire him the next day, put him on the transfer list and make it absolutely clear that it was this guy's fault. And Jürgen let him leave with dignity several months later. And that's not just sort of basic human decency. That's a very, very canny thing if you're managing a group of people, because they need to know that if it goes wrong, they're not going to be thrown to the wolves.
This sounds like the exact opposite of the way that Downing Street is currently being run, right?
Yeah.
One of the things that apparently made Mark Sewell decide he was going to leave is, you know, just the level of briefing already kind of coming out about the fact that, you know, the civil servants already feel that everything that went wrong in coronavirus, even the political decisions, is going to be blamed on them. You know, like the government had brilliant ideas. It just, you know, that the creaking old civil service who all clock off at 4 p.m. weren't able to deliver them. And that sense is really lethal. The idea that someone's kind of playing their own game, or like that you know, you can be a scapegoat, it just completely shatters morale.
Yeah, and that's why Liverpool have been able to play in this kind of supernatural way, in that, like, the players don't have any fear. There's an astonishing moment in the European Cup semi-final where Trent Alexander-Arnold, this prodigy from Liverpool, takes a corner in a most unexpected way.
That's incredible.
It is, a friend of mine described it as the most Scouse thing that's ever happened. Literally just stole the goal. And to have the audacity to do that, that has to come from somewhere. And it's because Klopp has given them the license to do what they can do. And I look at him and I just think there are so many things that everybody should learn from the way he does stuff. Like you mentioned, Philip, he knows what he doesn't know, and he brings in people who know what they're doing and lets them do it. And, you know, I'm sitting here thinking, I run these podcasts. I should be more like that. I should be less of a control freak. You know, as listeners can probably tell, I am a devotee and I would walk through the gates of hell for this man.
But you wouldn't be walking alone.
I wouldn't be walking alone. Helen, we're going to have to wrap the podcast up because I'm starting to go a bit. I'm just, you know, thinking about Jürgen.
Genuinely, in these straitened times, it is really pleasant just to listen to someone talk about something that they like sincerely love.
Yeah, it's just really one nice. Man and his love for a man called Jürgen. It's kind of beautiful.
Well, you know, he is my hero. That is it. So we've come to the end of the podcast. With seven games to go, we've wrapped it up, which means it's time to ask our panel for their escape routes from politics. The country may be opening up, but what are our panellists thinking about to take their minds off the thought of a second wave and politics in general? Ahir, what's your diversion of choice this week?
I've got a bicycle now.
Oh, right.
I'd never cycled in London before, even though I grew up here. I was always too afraid, but I sort of leapt on it because I'm like, I don't want to be doing public transport all the time. Get a cycle, go about town. I love it. I've become a Brompton evangelist.
A Brompton evangelist. I'm sure, yeah. I saw them at Glastonbury.
Everyone get one. Philip, now that I have one, everyone else get one.
And you can find them. Isn't there a bike shortage as a result of coronavirus? There's like a bike drought out there. Very hard to find bikes these days, I'm told.
Oh yeah, absolutely. When I initially wanted to get a bike, I went to a local branch of Evan Cycles, and the dude was just like, "The problem is that we do not currently possess bikes." It was very like you had one job. So.
Philip, what are you doing to take your mind off the churning world of politics at the moment?
That's a very good question. I was thinking about this because, to an extent, so much of entertainment these days has become political as well. Having said that, and so, for example, a lot of the books I've been reading, although they're not specifically about, you know, they're not work-related, they're still bizarrely about politics. But what I've just started reading is Matthew Sturgis's book about Oscar Wilde, which is a world away from contemporary politics, at least, or at least the bit I'm reading at the moment, which is all about his parents back in Dublin and so forth, and his dad dissecting dolphins.
Dissecting dolphins?
Yes, he was an ophthalmologist, and he was particularly interested in medicine and science, and for some reason at one stage he dissected a dolphin. So that's that has been shifting me away from 2020's daily grind of reality.
Pretty good. You can rely on Oscar. Helen, how about you?
Well, I've been reading Charles Moore's biography of Margaret Thatcher because I know how to have fun. But I'll tell you what, the 1974 to 1979 Parliament will really cheer you up because that was off the hook. You might know this already from the James Graham play This House, but there was at one point in the middle of it, there was an MP who was pretty sure he was going to get done for tax fraud, so he faked his own death and went to Australia.
Sweet.
John Stonehouse.
Yeah, Stonehouse, exactly. You know, we always kind of go, oh, you couldn't write 2020s politics. And you think, ah, come on. Until Michael Gove leaves his clothes on a beach and then is rediscovered living it up in Perth, you know, we've still got a way to go. So that plus Fossey Verdun on BBC iPlayer, which is about the choreographer Bob Fossey and Gwen Verdun, the dancer, which I'm really enjoying. If you like cabaret and musical theatre, then give it a go.
Well, I'm going to recommend a bit of telly as well. The Wu-Tang Clan documentary of Mics and Men on Sky, which is incredible. And, you know, you don't need to know anything about or even like hip hop. In fact, even if you detest hip hop, it is a fantastic thing to watch because it is the story of the African-American experience over the past 40 years. It is it's sociology. It's about Wu-Tang Clan growing up as friends on Staten Island, what they experience, how the politics of the environment shapes them. You've got astonishing scenes of them as little kids, you know, like, you know, the RZA and Old Dirty Bastard when they were little kids going to school and being harangued by white mobs, shouting the N-word at them as children. And, you know, I can't call myself a mega hardcore hip hop fan, but like I know my Wu-Tang, and I was amazed at the revelations in this. You know, the depth of it, and the fact that every single member of Wu-Tang Clan is an astonishing story, and there's nine of them. So you certainly don't get shortchanged. It's on Sky Documentaries at the moment, episodes 1 to 4. And let's face it, there is no better title for anything involved in hip hop than Of Mics and Men.
Andrew, I need to start running my pitches for things by you because you know how to sell shit to white people.
Selling shit to white people is my business, and business is tepid. Helen.
Oh, no, I was going to say there's a Dave Chappelle sketch called Wu-Tang Financial. I don't know if you've ever seen it, but the premise of which is that Wu-Tang hand out sound financial advice to people, which I was sorry, Rick. I'm sure it must be on YouTube. It's well worth watching.
Well, the truth there, of course, is Wu-Tang Plan ain't nothing to fuck with.
Exactly.
So let's remember that. Everyone, thank you so much for listening. Thank you to our special guest, Philip Sargent. Thank you for coming in, Philip, or dialing in.
Thanks. No, very enjoyable. Thanks.
I hear Shah and Helen Lewis. Thanks for joining us as ever. We'll be back tomorrow with another Bunker Daily and the full-length show this time next week. Don't forget, listeners, you can back us on the crowdfunding platform Patreon. Just see our Twitter or Facebook or search Patreon Bunker Podcast. There is the live stream on Zoom next Thursday the 9th, so that's for Patreon backers too. If you back us, you'll get a shout-out on the show as well. And here are some shout-outs right now.
Hello, and many thanks from me to Andrew Reed, Heather Walton, Angela and Terry Losker.
And it's thanks from me to... Oh, hold on. It's thanks from me when an egg is no longer being whisked. Yeah.
Can we just, like, stop mixing the yoghurt or whatever it is?
Yeah, can you stop that for a second? Sorry. And it's thanks and best wishes from me to Robert King, Chris Butt, Glyn Richards, and A. Hegarty. We're not sure which Hegarty. A. Hegarty.
Maybe it's Anthony and the Johnsons. Who knows? And finally, hello from me to Andrew Bumbalis, Kelly Webb-Davis, Judith Skorupski and Sally Bean. We'll see you next time.